The modern healthcare environment demands that physicians serve as effective leaders and managers in navigating new policies while still delivering high-value patient care and promoting workforce engagement. Yet a nationwide survey of dermatology residency program directors and chief residents revealed that an overwhelming minority of residency programs offer a formalized leadership curriculum. In this dialogue, Dr. Jeffrey Miller and Dr. Laura McGirt discuss focus principles of an MBA for dermatologists and offer an augmented skill set and diverse management perspectives to better address questions related to the business of dermatology.
Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Miller from Penn State Dermatology, and we're going to speak today about the principles of an MBA for the practicing dermatologist. Thank you for being with us today.
I'm excited to be here.
Great. So I wanted to start out by asking you a question about your training with the MBA and your background in this.
So I've been practicing dermatology now for over 15 years, and I practice at Penn State, as you said. So this is a university-based practice. And as I took on more administrative responsibility, I started to realize that we had a lot of business questions around the practice of medicine, specifically dermatology. And then I started to wonder, are we asking the right questions when it comes to a business problem? And if we're not asking the right question, then are we getting the right answer to solve the business problem? As my administrative responsibilities grew, I thought I really should think about getting additional training. And that was, for me, an important step to develop a new skill set. An MBA just makes you think differently. And a lot of people can develop this naturally, but for me, I had the opportunity to get an education formally, and it was really helpful.
That's great. Why do you think that the MBA principles are important for the general dermatologist?
So I'd say whether you are running a community-based practice or you're in the university-based setting, the principles of management are very, very similar. You're going to have a lot less bureaucracy, obviously, in a community-based practice, but the principles of management are the same. And today, what I hope to share with the listeners, again, I think can benefit regardless of practice type, are just some of the key principles. And you can't cover all the principles learned in an MBA, but these are just the key principles. And these are some of the key principles that have helped me really lead a team, because I think when you're in a practice setting, you're viewed as the leader. And as the leader, you're going to be making some tough business decisions. And so I hope that some of these focus principles will help everyone to ensure the success of their practice in this ever-changing healthcare environment.
That's great. So why don't we dive in, and you can start by, if you don't mind, telling us about one of these focus principles, and if you can relate it specifically to how that's changed your practice or examples that you've had, that'd be wonderful.
Sure. So one of the areas that we studied in our strategy course was change management. And I think change management was a great topic for healthcare because of, think of the Affordable Care Act. We're undergoing tremendous change. So what does it mean when you say change management? And when I talk to physicians, and I'll say, well, how do you lead a change in your practice? So for example, maybe you want to start a new type of clinic. You want to start a new type of service. How do you lead that change? And there's a process to leading that change. And I would say most of us don't have that skill set, and it's probably a gap in our education. So one of the change management principles that I think is really critically important when you're leading change is involve those affected by the change in the change. That is critically important because I think as physicians, we tend to be very prescriptive. We have the answer. But in leadership, with change management, you can let go as the leader and set the vision, get the guiding coalition together, get everyone on board, but empower those people affected by the change in the change. And that's been one of the most important lessons for me. And I can give you an example where I really screwed up. So when I took on more administrative responsibility, we wanted to start an evening clinic. Our practice never had an evening clinic. So I told the nursing staff and the front desk staff, we're starting an evening clinic on Thursday night. Well, that went over like a lead balloon. And they said, after we tried this out, they said, Jeff, this isn't really working out. And it dawned on me, I'm not applying one of the most important leadership principles, involve those affected by the change in the change. So we got the front desk staff together, the nursing staff together, and the physicians. And we said, well, why are we doing this? We're doing this to improve access and deliver on excellent patient service. But then let's talk about how we can do this so that we all benefit. And we learned that Thursday night was not the best night. It was better on Monday for a variety of reasons. We had an acute care clinic on a Thursday afternoon, and it just bled right into our Thursday evening clinic. Monday afternoon was a much better time to do it. We had better staffing. It was an easier transition point. So had I involved them in the change up front, I would have had much less time managing the change from the beginning. So I think that to me was one of the most important principles that I learned was, you know, involve those affected by the change in the change.
That is very good advice. And out of curiosity, how is the evening clinic going now? I'm sure many places would like to start them up themselves.
So yeah, I think it's our most well-received clinic because we're not impacting professionals who have to take time off work. Students don't have to miss school. And I think the staff has realized that, you know, this is a service that's going above and beyond. So the evening clinic has become part of who we are, part of our brand. And it reminds everyone of why we do what we do. We're here to serve our patients. And if we always think about serving our patients from our perspective, we won't always think about changing. If we think about their perspective, and again, you can apply, involve those affected by the change in the change, and maybe I should have had a patient on that guiding coalition group to get their perspective, because that would have been really powerful if you think about the impact that could have had up front. And you will learn that the people on the front line will give you the best solutions. And to me, it's made leadership a little bit easier, because you don't have to know all the answers.
What are some other principles that you've learned through the MBA that you've been able to apply to your practice?
So the other principle is around incentives. And I think that's the greatest motivation question in the entire world, is what is the incentive? And then the greatest management principle in the world is what gets rewarded gets done. And I think incentives are incredibly complex, and I think very hard to outline a structure that gets the behavior that you want from your team. And traditionally, I think we all think of incentives in financial measures. You know, it's the price effect. The more we pay, the more we reward in dollars, it's going to drive the behavior that we want. And I think that's true to an extent. I think everyone, from an incentive standpoint, you got to make sure your employees, whether you're in a community-based practice, a university-based practice, you got to make sure you're competitive. You know, look around. Don't benchmark yourself internally, but look around to your competitors. Make sure that financially you're taking care of them. And then think about your incentive structure, you know, from a financial standpoint. But the one thing I've learned with the financial incentives, which it's something that you just have to be aware of. Financial incentives can actually have a dampening effect when someone's intrinsically motivated to do what they're asked to do. So in healthcare, hopefully we are hiring people who are motivated to serve others. And sometimes if you have a financial incentive that is small, not significant, it can have a dampening effect on the intrinsic motivation to do what you want them to do. And for example, we want to improve our service. And if we're going to improve service for our patients as measured by whatever measure you're using, for us it's Press Ganey, a small financial award can have a negative impact because they're thinking, you have to pay me this little bit to get this type of behavior. I signed up for this because I want to do it. So that's something that I've learned. You got to be careful around financial incentives, especially when you are incentivizing behavior that is intrinsically motivated. Does that make sense? And the example I can use here, and this is more from a university-based perspective, is we have medical directors at our institution running practice sites, and we wanted to incentivize their productivity and their activity as a medical director. And the incentive pool really was a small dollar amount that could be distributed to the top performing medical directors. But it was so small, the negative backlash that we got was significant. Wait, you're going to give us this little bit of money for something that really, you know, we've signed up for this because we really want to do it. But I think if the incentive had been more significant from a financial standpoint, it would have driven the behavior a little bit better. But just remember, small financial incentives for some employees can have a negative effect on their intrinsic motivation. But I want to caution that because our secretary gave me good advice because she's heard me talk about these principles. And she said, Jeff, for an employee who's not making a lot of money, that's not in the physician scale, just remember, sometimes a small financial incentive goes a long way. That small financial incentive can mean it can cover the piano lessons for a child. I'm giving you broad strokes, and this is why incentives are messy, but I want you to know there's an upside and a downside to a financial incentive.
What are some other types of incentives that you've used besides the financial incentive?
The other incentives are the non-financial incentives, and I think non-financial incentives go a long way. And this is the part that I don't think you can be really prescriptive about. I learned from my brother who went to business school, and he sent me a note about incentives, and he said, you know, what I learned was that you can't change people, but you can change your environment. You can change a situation to drive the behavior you want. So I started thinking about that. What does that mean? And it dawned on me, our chairman does this very well. He creates an environment where you want to serve patients. So for example, a nurse gets a bouquet of flowers for a patient who gets a prior authorization. Well, he takes that bouquet and makes sure it's put into a nice vase and it's put in the center of the nurse's island. So every day, it's a reminder of why we do what we do, even though it can be a pain in the butt sometimes. But he's changing the environment to drive the behavior. That's a non-financial change. The other thing that he's done really well to change the environment was he has our values in very nicely, professionally done lettering around the nurse's station. You walk in every day and you see what our values are. And it's something from the fish philosophy called, you know, it's play, number one. That means have fun. Choose your attitude. Be there and make their day. And every employee can say those. But he also has it in the, he's changed the environment to drive the behavior. They see it on the walls each and every day. So, and then I think the other non-financial incentive is just the encouragement and the recognition through example, like a story at a staff meeting. Ask for a story where someone went above and beyond and have another coworker tell it. And it's amazing how that becomes part of the culture when you tell stories. And so those non-financial incentives, and I'm sure our listeners have many other examples that they use in their clinic, but those non-financial incentives can go a long way.
I agree completely with what you've said. I've seen institutions, I think, in this difficult economic time with such an emphasis on saving money and trying to make cuts, that the places that seem to be flourishing and having good morale are able to maintain those non-financial incentives and have a sense of pride and a sense of almost family and working together. And different places have been more or less successful at that. So that's, I think, a wonderful point that you make.
Yeah, the just to follow up on that. And then the last thing I just want to make the point is that we have a tremendous opportunity each and every day to tap into the incentive of altruism. And altruism is the number one driver of happiness, going outside of yourself. Daniel Gilbert is a researcher at Harvard who has spent his entire career studying happiness. And the number one driver of happiness is altruism. So I would say that's a non-financial incentive. That's a lever that we can tap into each and every day. But how we do it, that's why it's the tricky part. How we do it is the messy part of incentives. But I know that our dermatologists out there, we're a creative group. We're entrepreneurial, and I'm sure there are people who have great answers and great ideas. So what they need to do is get involved in at the academy and give a talk on this so that we can all learn. This is definitely, I think these types of business principles are a gap in our education, and it's something that we can all learn from one another.
As you alluded to previously with the changing medical environment that we have with the Affordable Care Act starting, how do you think the principles of the MBA, those that you have discussed and others that you've learned, are going to help traverse this new time for us?
Yeah, that's a tough question. So let's see if we can focus my answer. So the Affordable Care Act, it's been the law of the land now for 4 years, and that's a change. So I guess the one thing that I would think about as we move forward to ensure our success is involve those affected by the change in the change. It's incumbent upon dermatology to demonstrate its value to our patients, to the insurers, and even to the people in Washington. And if we don't demonstrate our value, value is defined as outcome divided by cost. And I do like to say outcome divided by elimination of waste. And I think in dermatology, we're at a time where we need to be part of that outcome definition. So what are those outcome measures that are meaningful? Because right now we have a lot of process measures in place. But what are those outcome measures, whether it's in Mohs surgery, whether it's in general dermatology, whether it's in the practice of aesthetics, what is it that is a meaningful outcome so that dermatology can demonstrate its value? And so again, if you apply the change management principle, involve those affected by the change in the change, I know that we have a great academy leadership. When you think of people like Brett Caldiron, you think of Jack Resnick, Abby Van Voorhees, who writes in Dermatology World, read the articles that they're writing, because what they're helping us understand that external environment, but we need to be part of that change effort. So I think right now with the Affordable Care Act moving forward, with payment reform, we're going to see this transition from volume to value, where we and I don't know when it's going to come, I don't know how it's going to come, but the traditional fee-for-service of seeing patient after patient, we may all of a sudden be viewed as an expense if you're involved in the management of a population. And if that happens, and I think it will happen, we need to understand our costs. You know, so how much does it cost to take care of a patient with X, Y, or Z in dermatology? And I think, you know, these are the changes that are happening with the Affordable Care Act that we will need to be involved in. And I think it's going to be a combination of the academy leadership and us, all of us, whether you're in the community-based practice or in a university-based practice, to help define those value measures to ensure that dermatology is always at the table.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for coming and talking with us today. And I know we've learned a lot from this conversation. We greatly appreciate you taking your time, Dr. Miller.
Yeah, thank you.
Among the concepts from his MBA training, which Dr. Miller has found applicable to dermatology practice, is that of change management and the need to involve those affected by the change in the change. As the traditional model of top-down command-based management has been deemed increasingly less efficacious in current-day workplace, a new leadership model of organizational conversation has emerged. Based on the research of individuals across over 100 companies, Groysberg and Slynn observed four I's, intimacy, interactivity, inclusion, and intentionality, as key features of a successful dialogue between managers and their employees. Even in a small practice setting, establishment of quality improvement or QI committees, consisting of representatives from both physician and non-physician staff, can aid in promotion of organizational conversation to shape policies and programs. Through direct engagement in decision-making processes, staff members can become active stakeholders in implemented policies and more emotionally committed to shared practice goals. Similarly, engaging patients directly in their care plan, in lieu of a prescriptive approach to treatment decisions, can also promote positive outcomes, including greater patient satisfaction. A study of 339 Mohs patients revealed that those who perceived themselves to have been involved in their treatment plan were more likely to express satisfaction 1 week following their procedure. Another study of patients in an outpatient dermatology clinic found that, among 28 aspects of their overall care, involvement in the treatment decision-making process and discussion of management options were among those deemed most important. Ascertaining patient satisfaction and outcomes has become paramount as pay-for-performance reimbursement models have emerged, and as maintenance of certification, or MOC, objectives call for physicians to periodically assess their clinical performance. Accordingly, Dr. Miller cites the need to make data-driven decisions in the practice of dermatology. Simple, score-based instruments such as the Physician Global Assessment, or PGA, and Patient Global Assessment, or PTGA, have been developed to capture clinical outcomes and have been shown to be helpful in evaluating treatment outcomes in acne and psoriasis patients. Web-based resources such as DrScore, created by dermatologist Dr. Steven Feldman, likewise can be utilized to obtain quantitative feedback regarding patient satisfaction. Of the principles discussed, perhaps it is the concept of value in healthcare that is at once most critical and challenging to understand. As appraised by the healthcare system, value is defined as health outcomes achieved per dollar spent or resources consumed. Harvard Business School professor Michael E. Porter elaborates eloquently on this concept. Quote, value should always be defined around the customer. The creation of value for patients should determine the rewards for all other actors in the system. Since value depends on results, not inputs, value in healthcare is measured by the outcomes achieved, not the volume of services delivered, and shifting focus from volume to value is a central challenge, end quote. It may be thus fitting, then, that business principles ultimately drive us back to a fundamental tenet of practicing medicine, that is, delivering patient-centered care of the highest quality.